We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. I'm glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about relations between Russia and the United States. It is certainly true that relations between the two countries in the final years of the Bush administration were marked by some tension. Now, with a new administration, there are many people who feel that it's possible that the two countries can make something of a fresh start and begin again. And while I think one could say that relations certainly between the two governments at this point are cordial, they have elected to begin with perhaps some of the easiest things, and certainly there are still things that divide the two countries. In this hour of focus, we'll be trying to talk a little bit about the possibility of a new agenda for Russian-American relations. And our guest for the program here is Andranik Migranian. He is director of the Institute for Democracy and Cooperation in New York. Now, this is a New York branch of something that is based in Moscow in Russia. They also, I believe, have a branch in Paris.
Yes.
Is that right? It's been here in the United States for just a couple of years. He is a graduate of the Moscow State Institute of International Relations and has specialized in issues of American politics and socialism and international social democratic movement. He is an academician of the Academy of Political Science and also professor at the Moscow State Institute of International Relations. He's published a number of books, many articles in some of the leading Russian and international publications, and frequently has been commentator on both television and radio. During his career, he's held several key advisory positions at the Duma, that is the parliament in Russia, and the Federation Council, was at one time a close advisor to Boris Yeltsin. And he's here visiting the campus, his visit sponsored by the Russian East European and Eurasian Center, and he will be giving a talk this afternoon at 4 on the campus. This is at the Levis Center on West Illinois and Urbana. And it's an event I'm sure that anyone should feel welcome to attend. Here this morning on the program, your calls are welcome. We just ask people to keep their comments brief, but questions are welcome. 333-9455 is the number. We also have a toll-free line. Good any way that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Thank you very much for being here.
Oh, you are welcome. Thank you for inviting.
Perhaps we could talk a little bit about Russian-American relations during the final years of the Bush administration, when there was some fairly strong rhetoric on both sides. I'm not exactly sure how this started, but certainly here in the United States, Vice President Cheney said some very strong things about Russia, and in response, Mr. Putin said some strong things back. How would you account for that level of tension in the relationship at that point? What do you think were the major points of contention?
Oh, major points of contention were a couple of things which still are there, but we hope that might be with this new administration, Moscow and Kremlin can handle that better than they did with White House under Bush and Cheney. Mm-hmm. First of all, it concerns the problem of NATO expansion to eastward involving new countries except the former Eastern European countries who belong to the Warsaw Pact bloc, even former Soviet republics, which created a serious tension between Moscow and NATO and Washington. And second, this is the problem of post-Soviet space, especially after so-called colored revolutions in Ukraine and in Georgia, where practically new governments became very hostile to Russia and very anti-Russian, and they were supported by Washington and especially by Cheney and Cheney-type people in administration. As a result, we got Munich speech of Putin when he told that this kind of arrogant behavior of U.S. is intolerable and U.S. is trying to treat Russia and others as defeated countries with limited sovereignty. And Russia requires a policy which could, you know, respect Russia as an equal partner. And this is the exact way of treating other countries if you want to have a cooperation rather than competition.
Mm. Just, I think, to make people sure that people understand, and certainly my understanding that in during the time when the Soviet Union still existed, that as Russia thought of its sphere of influence, it was very important to see that as not just something that had to do with perhaps desiring to have political influence in what you Russians thought was their own backyard, but it had serious security considerations as well. That the Russian heartland was, you might say, surrounded by two different rings. One would have been made up of the various Soviet republics, and then there were the countries that were independent countries, but that were part of the Warsaw Pact and had strong ties to Russia. So once there was no more Soviet Union, once these countries truly became independent, and as things sort of started to fall apart, I'm sure that within Russia there was real concern about the security implications for Russia of that.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You know, the final years of perestroika period when Gorbachev was the Soviet president, there were serious discussions in Moscow. Really, it's possible to withdraw Russian Soviet forces from these Eastern European countries? Really, it's possible to let them to make free elections and became really independent and to get rid of communism and communist party dominations over there? Everybody thought that it's fine, but what's going to happen with security interests of Russia and Soviet Union, with the geostrategic, geopolitical situation in the world after that? And at that time, Moscow heard from Washington and other Western capitals that nobody is going to change radically the balance of power, which means Eastern European countries will be a neutral, a positively oriented towards the West and towards the Soviet Union, because Soviet Union was letting them go, letting them be independent without shooting even, you know, a pistol or anything, because it was a deliberate policy of Soviet Union's leadership at that time, really to democratize, really to put an end of this kind of old-type Soviet empire and let them be independent. But in response, they wanted to have some guarantees that it's not going to harm the security interests of Soviet Union. And this kind of guarantees Soviet leadership got from Bush administration. Bush elder Baker came to Russia and said that German unification, it's fine, and if Russia would like, Germany could be outside of NATO, a neutral country, or even if Germany will be inside the NATO, Eastern Germany is not going to be part of a NATO. NATO is not going to enlarge even an inch eastward. The same was told by Chancellor Kohl to Gorbachev. But practically, Gorbachev was deceived. This was not formulated and printed down and signed in documents. As a result, President Clinton came and said, we don't have any binding documents. That's why we can go ahead and involve Eastern Germany and Eastern Bloc countries into a NATO, which was, I think, a very, very serious mistake in foreign policy done by American administration, because instead of involving Russia, instead of making Russia part of a Western world, they practically pushed Russia away, hostilized, and created endless tension between East and West, mm-hmm. between Russia and the Western bloc.
This seems to be maybe the first and maybe most fundamental mistake that the West made after the Cold War, something that I'm sure that many Russians resented, and that was they treated Russia as if it just didn't matter anymore.
That's true, and you know what is important? When the Cold War just ended in Moscow and in Washington and other capitals, usually the tune was completely different. Everybody was speaking about the joint victory over communism and totalitarianism. Mm-hmm. But very soon it turned to be that Soviet Union was defeated, Russia was defeated, West won the victory over the Russia, and you can treat this country like a defeated country. And, you know, you have in this country a very good strategist, a guy like Mike Mandelbaum. I hope you is now professor in Johns Hopkins, but worked in Council on Foreign Relations. In many recent publications, he mentioned that, you know, every war is finished by designing the new world structure and new world order. And usually world order after this kind of wars, world order is stable if you, in your design, involve defeated with winners in making an arrangement to have a stable situation in the world. But in cases when you are not doing this, like after First World War, when Versailles system humiliated and kicked out Germany, then you are getting a revanchist power which is not ready to accept all these terms. It's a humiliation. It's a desire to have a revenge, to restore your place in the world. You have your dignity, your ambitions, your expectations, and it is an endless potential for tension. But after Second World War, Germany and Japan were involved in this Western security, political, economic structures, and they became responsible partners for the Western countries in creation of a new world. And in this case, as Mandelbaum and many others are mentioning, involvement of Russia, making Russia a partner, a responsible player in world scene, could be much better than using this temporary weakness of Russia just to grab anything you can grab. Mm. It creates a tension, and it doesn't create a stability in the long run.
Well, it cannot be, though, that Russia would feel threatened by Germany or France or Poland or Czech Republic.
You know, Russia is not feeling that it is threatened. There is a threat on behalf of Poland or Germany or France. But, you know, Russia feels itself very uncomfortable that there is a Western military political bloc to whom Russia doesn't belong. Mm. And this bloc has enormous potential, military potential, economic potential, political potential, to make a pressure on Russia. Today, you don't do that, but, you know, we are judging about the politics not because of your intentions, but because of your potential. You have the potential. Today, you have a good feeling to me. You don't do any harm, but tomorrow you can do that, which means you must be ready. That's why geopolitics is a kind of science which is equal to mathematics. If you have a resource to protect yourself, you are fine. If not, you are very vulnerable. That's why Russia feels itself very vulnerable, especially if now there were talks about and Bush administration were pushing forward the process of Ukrainian and Georgian, joining the NATO.
The NATO, yeah. I had a caller. I made them wait too long. My apologies. If people want to call in, certainly they should, and we'll get them in. At various points when people have been talking about NATO expansion, even raising the question of NATO necessary anymore, people, I think, have raised the possibility that, well, someday perhaps Russia would be invited to join NATO. If Russia was invited to join NATO, would it accept?
A kind of insider for many years in Russian politics. First, after the collapse of Soviet Union, Russian government said that Russia is ready to join the NATO. Mm-hmm. But NATO turned down that. Mm-hmm. And second time, that happened when Putin came to power. And Russia was expecting this kind of thing after Russia joined America in America's efforts to destroy Taliban in Afghanistan. But it didn't happen. Russia helped Americans to deal with Taliban and to practically, on initial stage of war, to destroy everything in Afghanistan, all this Al-Qaeda and others. But after that, Russia was said, yeah, okay, you did your job, now just stay away and wait. Might be next time we'll ask you to come and join us in doing some other things. And this was a big disappointment in Russia because really at that time a kind of expectations rose that this is a new stage and new possibilities for closer cooperation between Russia and NATO, Russia and U.S., especially if we take into account that first time Article 5 went into action in this North Atlantic Treaty Organization, that one country is attacked, all other countries are attacked, they have to join and go together to fight the enemy. And Russia was part of that coalition, and might be Russia's contribution was more decisive than any other NATO country's contribution in destroying Taliban in Afghanistan.
Let me introduce again the guest for this hour for anybody who might have tuned in. We're talking with Andronik Migranian. He is director of the New York office of the Institute for Democracy and Cooperation, something that is based in Moscow. He's been in New York now, I think, since, was it 2008?
In Russia, we established that in 2007, but in 2008, we registered that in New York.
He's a political scientist in Russia for a long time, has been following American politics and has done a lot of writing, books, articles in some of the leading Russian and international publications, has often commented on this and other subjects for Russian television and radio. And he is here visiting the campus. He'll be talking about this question, is a new agenda for Russian-American relations possible? This is this afternoon at 4 o'clock on the campus. His visit here sponsored by the folks at the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center. Questions welcome, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And we do have a caller here. Let's bring them in. Someone in Effingham to start us off, line number 4. Hello.
Thank you, David. This is such a broad subject and historical. And in order to keep it short, I think that everyone needs to understand, and I think your guest does, the hegemony of oligarchical classes and the use of capitalism and how it has been the scourge of the world for 700 years. Russia played its part, too, and under the old monarchy and the emergence of a bourgeois class there late in the 19th century. But the central point I want to try to make is since the Taliban have been brought up into the conversation, that when they came to power in Afghanistan, they had been abandoned by the U.S., and then the struggles in the Eastern Asia and Arabia and the sorts of machinations that the Western powers have exercised there for a very long time, especially England, and the treatment of the population in those places, the mixed with the Crusades, and then in the 18th and 19th centuries, the taking of their natural resources. And I'll finish by saying, if I were an Arab or an Asian, I would have a dedicated contempt for Western hegemonists who continue to rape the world. And thank you. I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
I'm not sure I find a question in there. I don't know if you can respond to some of the things that the caller said.
No, it's not a question. I think that just the caller wanted to say that the opposition to Western hegemony over there is legitimate on behalf of these people. Yeah, nobody argues that, but the problem is Americans and Westerners at this time at least came to that place in response to attack against this, New York twins and attacks in Washington and other places, which means this was a counter-terrorist action on behalf of the coalition rather than an attempt to come and to dominate over there. Of course, unfortunately, later on, when there was an American, invasion in Iraq, and then Bush, when they failed to find any weapons of mass destruction, tried to justify this action in order that they are coming to bring democracy to this place. Of course, in this case, this turned to be a farce because it's hard to come in order to find the weapons of mass destruction. And then when you fail to find it, to say that the purpose is completely different and we are nation building, regime building, which is, of course, a failure in advance. Nobody can do that. And now American new administration understood that it's practically unachievable goal. And that's why it's much better to pull back the troops, to bring them home and to let them live as they would like to live.
Let's talk with someone else here. Champagne, it's line one. Hello.
Yeah, I was wondering if the guest could comment on the role or on what happened in the last few years regarding the flow of energy to Europe and how that played into the impression that the West turned their back on Russia and tried to isolate Russia and shutting off the pipelines, etc.
Oh, it's a good question, but unfortunately, even judging the nature of question, one can say that this is a kind of cliché which is widely circulating in the West, that Russia is going to use its energy resources as a kind of tool for chantaging the West and creating the problems for the West. This goes back to the 70s when there was a deal, gas for pipes. At that time, Soviet Union wanted to have this bigger diameter pipelines in order to transport gas to Europe. But neither under communists nor in modern times Russia used really the gas or oil in political goals. And Russia is a very reliable supplier of the West by gas and oil. But what is really happening, and this is a problem, is that we have several countries which had their own problems with Russia under communist period and after the communist time. This is Poland, Ukraine. They are transit countries. Through territories of these countries, pipelines are going to Western Europe, and from time to time these countries are raising their demands, and in case of Ukraine, they are just stealing the gas because they don't have money to pay for that. And for many years, Russia couldn't do anything because to turn off the faucet of the pipeline, you can create a problem for your end users in Germany, in Italy, in other places. But then eventually, last year, Russia decided to do that. And really, they said, as much as you are stealing, not paying for that, that much we are cutting the supply to Europe. And then Ukraine and Europe, they must discuss between themselves what to do. This is not our problem. We are selling, you are buying. But somebody in the middle is stealing. Who is the problem? Ukraine wanted to make a problem Russia and to confront Russia with the West. But because of the very, cold winter last year, Europeans said, listen to Ukraine, though we have sympathy to you, but don't steal our gas because we need that for our purposes. And now, by the way, Russia is diversifying its pipelines, and that's why they finalized their negotiations with northern countries in Scandinavia, the Finland, Denmark, and Sweden, for building this Nord Stream to Germany directly, surpassing Belarus, Ukraine, and Poland. They are not happy because they are not getting the money for transit, and they can't chantage Russia or chantage Europe even. And Russia is going to build another South Stream through Balkans, also surpassing, Ukraine. Also, these countries are not happy. But they are not happy because they are not, reliable partners. They are creating the problem, and Russia is diversifying its pipelines, which means this is not a threat for Europe. This is an additional, confirmation that supply will be reliable, and Russia is going to be a reliable partner for its Western European partners who can pay what they are going to consume.
So I have a follow-up then. It seems that the Ukraine is in bad shape.
Ukraine is bankrupt because they have no money, 20% decline this year, and they borrowed money from IMF. IMF can't give them the money because not having money, the president fighting the prime minister because they have forthcoming elections, increased social benefits. And government said, we don't have any money. How you are going to raise the social benefits? This is the situation in this country. Russia has nothing to do with this situation. If you don't have money, you can't grab the money from the others. You have to pay for that.
Right. Well, but my question is, as far as it seems like it's going to be difficult having unstable, poor countries on the border between the wealthy Western countries and Russia. And that might lead to a lot of political problems.
Yeah, that's true. That's why since the last elections, presidential in Ukraine, it was December 2004. Until today, this country is practically constantly in crisis, in political crisis, in economic crisis. Two or three times, the country's parliament was dissolved, new elections in order to create a new configuration of power, an attempt to find a balance between executive and legislative power. And they failed to find it. That's why it's a problem. And that's why I think that Russia and especially Washington, they have to come together and to try to solve the problem. Because really, once Putin said that Ukraine is not yet a consolidated country, it's falling apart. They were, they felt themselves as assaulted or insulted. But this is the reality. And, of course, if they can do that inside, it's necessary for the partners and allies to come together and to solve the problem.
Thank you.
All right. If one is a country like Ukraine or Georgia, you have a very powerful neighbor like Russia, and you have some differences with them, you're going to go looking for powerful friends. And there's maybe no more powerful friend than the United States. What I have heard you say in perhaps in some other interviews, that though what Russia is saying to the United States is, if you would like to have our cooperation in places where you would like our cooperation, like Iran, for example, that what we're really going to expect from you is, as far as these sorts of disputes that we might have with our neighbors like Georgia, Ukraine, and any place else, that Russia is saying to the United States, what we'd really like you to do is just mind your own business and not get involved, or maybe, you know, not get involved to too much of an extent.
Yeah, you put that in a bolder way, Ivan.
Not very diplomatic, I know.
Yeah, no, it's fine. It's okay, because really I wrote many times, I have many publications on this issue. The last one was in the National Interest Online about Iran,
right,
if you
yes.
have seen that.
Yes.
Yeah, the problem is that every big country, especially big country, has a legitimate interest to have in its borders a friendly, stable, non-hostile neighbors. Not having on their territories foreign military bases, not belonging to any military organizations to which this big country doesn't belong. This is a legitimate desire, you know, especially in this country. Everybody understands that, who has some historical knowledge. Since Monroe Doctrine and later on, this country doesn't want anybody to come here to have in Central America, in Canada, in Mexico, their bases, bring them to Warsaw Pact or to any different kind of pacts and have hostile regimes over there against U.S. This is, for Americans, very understandable. This is exactly the desire, not to limit their sovereignty, not to make them any harm, but just to be sure that you have reliable, peaceful, stable neighbors, not hostile to you. This is exactly what Russia wants. Mm-hmm. It's not that much. And as I formulated quid pro quo, then after that, we can discuss the problems where we can cooperate together. This is Afghanistan, this is Iran, this is non-proliferation, this is energy supply, and many, many other things. Welcome.
Yeah. You talked a little bit earlier about the issue of NATO expansion, and this is something that I know has concerned Russia very much throughout the post-Cold War period, where initially Poland, Czech Republic, Hungary joined, then a number of other countries joined, including the Baltic states and Bulgaria and Romania, Croatia, Albania, and now there has been some discussion about the admission, as you say, of Ukraine and Georgia. And Russia is very, very unhappy about that possibility. I think they've not been happy about NATO expansion all along, but we're getting to the point where there seem to be some real desire on the part of the Russian government to draw some lines. And I'm not exactly sure what the thinking these days is in Washington, particularly about Georgia and Ukraine joining NATO.
As I read and I met with American officials in White House, in Congress, and in State Department, and as far as I knew from Russian side, having my meetings with officials in government in other places who participated in the last summit in Moscow, U.S. tacitly gave Russia an understanding that it's not going to push forward the process of admission of Ukraine and Georgia and no new wave of NATO expansion. Mm-hmm. Because NATO itself is becoming a problem. And this institution is becoming, for U.S. at least, this is my understanding, useless organization. Because it was designed against Soviet Union for America's presence in Europe vis-a-vis potential Soviet expansion and attack. Now, all major challenges to U.S. interests are outside of Europe. And outside of Europe, these European countries can play any serious role. Look at the situation in Afghanistan or Iraq. NATO has some forces over there, but very limited possibilities to increase its forces. And second, they are not combatants there. They are doing some training, they are doing some logistical things, some other things, but NATO as an organization has very limited potential. And even on top of that, if this war in Afghanistan is going to be a failure for NATO, it's going to be a biggest defeat for NATO. The first time NATO is involved in a kind of operation, and I must tell you that it's not that successful. That's why President Obama, the day before yesterday, proposed this idea of the surge, 30,000 more troops over there, 18 months deadline, and every expert knows that it's going to be a real, really very tough thing for U.S. to achieve its goals over there.
Let me just very quickly mention that we have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, and also introduce again our guest, Andranik Migranian. He's the director of the Institute for Democracy and Cooperation based in New York. Now, this is the New York branch of something that actually is based in Moscow, in Russia. He's a Russian political scientist interested in, among other things, American political system. He's professor at the Moscow State Institute of International Relations. He's here visiting the campus. We'll give a talk this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Levis Center, talking about the possibility of a new agenda for Russian-American relations. People are welcome to attend. Questions here are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have some callers here. Let's talk with somebody calling on a cell phone here, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just had a question. Wouldn't it negate the problem if Russia were to just join NATO?
We talked about that a little bit earlier, and perhaps I guess we can recap. I asked the guest, and he in fact said that there would have been a point when Russia would have been interested, and it seemed at that point at least the West was not interested in having Russia join.
Yeah, that's true, because many Western countries, they think that it's going to be a disaster for NATO because Russia is too big, being inside the NATO, having a veto power. Then these countries who try to convince Washington that they are threatened by Russia, they need to be inside of NATO, they will have Russia next to them inside the NATO, which means, again, this will create for them, but this is not real, but imaginary threat, which they feel. This is a kind of phantom pains, you know, for Poland, for Baltic republics, for others. That's why, unfortunately, this possibility is, at least at this moment, is not an option to be Russia inside the NATO. But this is not Russia's fault. This is Western fault, because they are against it.
I understand. Thank you for your comment.
Let's go to someone else here, Champaign County, line two. Hello.
Hi, I apologize for the other call I'm not taking now, but I didn't hear the very beginning, I regret, but I've been preoccupied for a while with what some people call the looting during the Yeltsin period, and there was a specific case of the Bank of New York Mellon was being sued. I think it might have been settled in an agreement for something like triple damages, because they were doing it under a RICO statute, and we know there was a lot of larceny, but it never gets really spoken of much here. It's an interesting sideline that the Bank of New York Mellon is a half share of the Georgian State Bank, and that's not Georgia in the U.S. That's the Georgia that has been a problem. Formerly included and divided off by Stalin, actually, or the territories were. And it's a bit of a complicated circumstance that's very, very infrequently visited. I guess I'd just ask you to for an open-ended comment on that. And also, one finds very little in English on the Russian case about seeking redress from the looting. Obviously, the oligarchs were doing a lot of internal looting as well, but the complicity of banks like Bank of New York Mellon, apparently, whether it's been adjudicated or not, is rarely commented upon. I guess it's the, well, I don't get biblical. I guess that's enough for you to comment on in the last few minutes. I'll just hang on momentarily and see if that was clear enough. Sir?
Yeah. We got, can you respond?
Yeah, I remember that scandal concerning Bank of New York, because a lot of people really stole the money, transferred these funds from Russia to Bank of New York. Then they were caught here by some authorities in money laundering, bringing from different places this illegal money and then distributing that here and there. This was a common practice in the 90s because though some people consider the period of Yeltsin in the 90s as a period of democracy, but unfortunately at that time, no smell of democracy. This was a real oligarchic rule, a very weak government, very weak president, oligarchs controlling the government and everything, weak institutions, and they were grabbing and transferring the money and transferring this through different kind of schemes, illegally and mainly illegally. That's why this was continuing process until recently. That's why at that time in the 90s there were a lot of publications, because in American side the authorities were involved and they wanted to find out from where money is coming, who is in charge, how it's distributed inside the U.S. And Russian authorities at that time were not very much interested in this, because this was additional scandal and additional, you know, damage for the reputation of Russia as a state. But now this is not the case, because state is more consolidated and this kind of lootings are not there, and the schemes are more transparent and more understandable how money is coming out and where money is going.
I hope that gets at the caller's question. We have just about 5 minutes. I want to try and get one more up in the northwestern part of the state. Paw Paw, line four. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I was wondering, I'm a big space nut, basically. The space, NASA, the space agency, they're going to be losing their shuttle next year. And I was wondering, is Russia up to the task at hand? Can they cover all the tasks that need to be done for NASA, and is it safe? I've been watching, because I get the NASA channel, I've been watching, and I know some people that work for NASA, and some of the things that I've seen and heard, I'm really skeptical about. It's more the safety issue than anything else. And I wanted to comment on that, and I'll get off. Thank you.
All right. I don't know. Is that an area where you think that there's greater possibility of the two countries working together?
Yeah, I think I was in Denver, and I was on panel in Denver during the Democratic Convention, and Senator Nelson on the panel was very unhappy speaking about this cooperation in space when he said that American shuttles are going to be out of service, mm-hmm. and it's going to be a complete reliance on Russian spaceships. And there was supposed to be American contribution in financing this project on their behalf together with Russians. And he said that after this war with Georgia, might be the Senate will not be happy, or the Congress will not be happy to finance the project. But I don't think that there is any proof that Russian spaceships are not reliable. They are working, they are doing their job, and I think there is no technical problems in continuing this. And I hope that because this new administration laid behind all these Russian-Georgian problems and it's looking forward, in this area, it's going to be even closer and larger cooperation than in the past.
We have just maybe about 5 minutes here. One of the big points of tension during the Bush presidency between Russia and the United States was the Bush administration planned to put an anti-missile system in Eastern Europe. And the idea was that there would be missiles in Poland, and then the radar that would control them was going to be in the Czech Republic. And Russia was very, very unhappy about this. This was something that I think the Obama administration didn't want to do it. So they announced in September that, in fact, that they were scrapping this plan. So here, at the same time, the Obama administration could wipe off something that they really didn't want to do anyway, which would actually have a positive effect on the relationship between the two countries, because Russia didn't want to see the United States go ahead and do this. Has that actually been something that's been positive for the relationship, removing that one very difficult issue?
It's a good question. The problem is that really Russia was unhappy with that, and Russia endlessly mentioned that it's an imaginary threat on behalf of Iran, which hasn't not delivery systems, not had the weapons of mass destruction, and all these kind of things. But by the way, Obama and Democrats in advance were critical and they were opposing this, which means when decisions were made, some commentators jumped and said, oh, now Russia in response has to go and make concessions here and there and there. But my response to this on BBC was that, you know, I said, listen, Obama said, we are not doing this because of Russia's pressure. We are doing this because the previous decision was wrong, first. Second, Americans don't have money just to waste, to throw them away, because America is practically bankrupt. $1 trillion debt holder is China. And enormous deficit, $12 trillion, you know, state debt. And huge budget deficit, you don't have money. And the third, yes, of course, because Russia endlessly was against this deployment, Russia is happy. But Russia has not to give anything back because this was wrong decision. This is the correction on behalf of American administration. But this is a good sign. As Russia's good sign and measure, to let Americans to supply arms through Russian territory to Afghanistan. And especially having in mind that it's going to be a surge for 30,000 people over there, the necessity for this route is becoming even much more important, because from Pakistan, this supply is very unreliable.
Yeah. Well, we're coming to the point where we have a minute or so left. The Obama administration came in and said in a very clear and deliberate manner that they were hoping to get a fresh start in relations between the two countries.
As they formulated it, they would like to have a reset.
Yes, that was the thing. I think it was the vice president, Mr. Biden, I think that he said, I don't know if that was his phrase, but he said, we want to push the reset button. Let's see if we can go take a few steps back. So
Obama's special assistant on Russia, senior director on Russian affairs in NSC, told me that he, coined the phrase "the reset" for Biden for his Munich speech, last year. This is the problem. How we understand the problem of reset and this fresh new start. If it's only the change of tune and we are ready to say nice words to each other and to have a dialogue instead of monologue, because previous administration, Bush and Condoleezza Rice, they just wanted to be mentors. They didn't want to have a dialogue and to listen and to try to figure out what their partners want and what their interest is. At least after this first summit, in Moscow, we had the comment that this administration is ready to listen and to find out what are the partners' interests. how far they can go in taking into account in their decisions, it's not clear yet, because Russia is getting mixed signals. Obama is telling that, yeah, we are not going to enlarge the NATO, we are not going to do this or that, but Biden is visiting that places, or some other members of administration visiting some other places and sending another signal, which is, creating a kind of confusion in Moscow. But very soon we'll see, because very soon this is the, deadline for Iran's problem. America is going to make some tough measures, and it depends how Russia is feeling itself in this area of reset to join America in on the sanctions against Iran or not. And we have this forthcoming Ukrainian elections. Are we going to cooperate or again to compete each other in this? These two things will show how this new agenda is going to show itself.
There we must stop, with our thanks to Andranik Migranian. He's director of the New York office of the Institute, the Moscow-based Institute for Democracy and Cooperation. And he's here on the campus visiting, sponsored by the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center. He'll be speaking this afternoon at 4 o'clock in the Levis Faculty Center in the music room. That's at on West Illinois in Urbana. And I'm sure anyone who is interested in stopping by to hear him should feel welcome. Thank you very much.
Thank you for inviting.